you very much, Mr. Bassett. Our next speaker has the distinction of being a high and influential figure at a major private university, Stanford University, somewhat subversively appointed to the board of the University of California. I'm not sure whether this has created some schizophrenia in his character or not, but I'm assured on reliable authority that the National Guard of California was called out for that meeting because of our next speaker, not because of Governor Reagan. You probably have been misled. Easily the most influential member of the board, our next speaker, Glenn Kim.
Kim, thank you for that extravagant introduction. I'll pay you off later, but whatever you wish to be paid. I also want to say in terms of my talk today, you're going to get quite a contrast between Mr. Bassett and me. He carefully prepared a formal talk and stole most of the things I was going to say to you. Now, my talk is my scribbled notes on the plane coming east the other day after I'd had two martinis. Now, I thought that was somewhat appropriate when talking about the University of California. In fact, I usually had three after a board meeting. In terms of schizophrenia and conflicts of interest, you may have read in the newspapers the other day that Linus Pauling thought prospects weren't as great as they used to be at the University of California. So he got a job at Stanford. Well, I'm happy to say that UC's gain was Stanford's loss. And I'd like also to say on this, in view of these attributes of the trustee, that I am under 50 years of age. My income's a hell of a lot under $100,000. And I work a hell of a lot more than 85 hours a year. Now, but I must say the same point, along the same line that Mr. Bassett said, that whoever put this program together is a real whip, because to use the heading, "Who is in Charge?" for a session in which university trustees and regents are the discussion leaders, not only are we not in charge, but most of the time we don't know what the hell we're doing. Now, it seems to me, maybe this is my UC experience, but it's quite clear who's in charge these days. It's the radical students and the radical faculty. Or as Max Rafferty once said when he got carried away a little bit of it. He may have gotten carried off too. I'm sure there were a lot of our fellow regents who would have liked to have done it. But he said, I suppose we might as well put the inmates in charge. All this reminds me of the way one of my Stanford colleagues treated me. When I was appointed as a regent about a year ago, he went up to me and he said, "You know, Campbell," he said, "your career has been downhill all the way." He said, "You started out in life the member of the faculty at Harvard. You've been a member of the administration for some years at Stanford. So now you're a college trustee." He said, "How much lower can you get?" But to illustrate this point a bit further, I happen to have a favorite story on my appointment, which always goes over big at the University of California, particularly at Berkeley, because it nicely fits their image. They're very objective about these things, of course, as scholars always are. It fits their image of our governor. As Many of you here should know, if you don't, I have a very famous namesake. He only has one N in his first name, but his income, I'm sure, is well over $100,000. But the story is that it wasn't until midway through the second meeting of the Board of Regents after I was appointed that the governor realized he hadn't appointed the country singer. My answer to this has always been, and I was particularly encouraged after listening to those statistics. The only thing wrong is he's a little young, but he's white and he's Protestant and he's got an income of a great deal over $100,000. But my answer is, in my opinion, the country singer would have made a great deal better regent than the UC faculty's idea of Eldridge Cleaver as a member of the Berkeley faculty. My wife tells me I should stop this because one of these days all these suits that Mr. Bassett mentioned, the country singer will sue me for slander. But on this matter of a college or university trustee, I think the best description I was ever given was one by Peter Bauer, whom a great many of you may know, who's a professor at the London School of Economics, and that was that being a college trustee or regent or whatever it is in the United States, here is the American equivalent of a minor British knighthood. You have roughly the same amount of power, prestige, not to mention pay. But I will say this, as far as being a regent of the University of California, I don't know about other colleges in this country, but it is a wonderful refresher course in four-letter words. Since going on the board a year ago, I've been called a mother lover so many times, a pig, a fascist, and various other terms of endearment, whether the police were there or not, that I'm at the point where I feel as if I'm not doing a good job unless this happens to me. Now, historically, as Mr. Bassett mentioned, virtually all the powers of the American University belong to the Board of Trustees. As he also mentioned, we've long since given practically all of them away. In fact, there are a good many people, particularly faculty members in this country, who would agree, I'm sure, that that's been our greatest achievement. On the UC system, we gave away our control over courses and curricula around about 1920. We've gradually also given up virtually all our control over appointments until along in 1966, that distinguished educator that you all know, who was then president of the University of California, Clark Kerr, convinced the Board of Regents in the interest of efficiency, decentralization, all these wonderful terms that appeal to a board made up of tycoons, that the board should give up its approval over tenured professors. So as a result, we got Herbert Marcuse. as a result of Herbert Marcuse, recently we've been trying to take this power back. And I'm told when we gave it up in 1966, we were all told there's really nothing to it. You know, it's a delegation, you can take it back any time. Well, you should have been at the meeting of our Board of Regents a week ago today. We were treated to the most impassioned arguments about how this would be interpreted as political interference. Our faculty never engaged in that sort of thing, of course. Would discourage good faculty from coming to the University of California, and all over the country it would be interpreted as a retrogressive act by the leader of public education. In fact, the whole performance there was enough to make a poor regent feel completely unloved, unwelcome, and incompetent. Maybe we are, I don't know, but I find it very difficult to understand why this is an act of such great importance. On the ROTC issue, we run into the same problem. It's very difficult for boards really to keep ROTC functioning. I found, much to my surprise, the University of California, that the faculty can change the number of course credits you get for graduation, even though we still have a provision in the standing orders and bylaws that the Board of Regents must approve conditions for degree. Now, we, at least in that board, in my opinion, are about down to the situation where it's always seemed to me that most faculty, and I apologize to faculty people here, and I regret to say also most administrators, feel we belong. Namely, in the private colleges, we should be money raisers, and of course, raisers of money over and without any say over how it's spent. It's very important to differentiate the raising part from the spending part. That's a very important faculty prerogative. You can very easily interfere with academic freedom, free speech, or any number of things if you start wanting to say how it should be spent. The public universities, of course, were supposed to use our influence to convince the state legislatures and the governor not to be so darn stingy with the taxpayers' money. Now, in California, we have an additional theory here. This is the famous buffer theory. A good university administrator can make a speech on this at the drop of a hat. That the function of the regents is to protect the faculty, the students, and the administration from the momentary and unreasonable passions of the people. This, of course, is the reason why we have to have 16-year terms. Since Governor Reagan was elected governor, there's been a great increase in the support of 16-year terms for regents on the part of the faculty at the University of California. I'm sure if we get an appropriately liberal governor, that enthusiasm will somewhat tail off, and many people would be able to see the case for replacing me. Now, here's a related role, and Mr. Bassett has scooped me here for regents, and I find many of my fellow regents take quite seriously, and that is our duty to solemnly rubber stamp whatever the faculty or administration proposes. Now, I wouldn't object to that so much if we weren't so darn sanctimonious about it. As I recall, my first regents meeting, I was taken aside by various people, both regents and administrators, and received more or less the same advice. In fact, I even received it in the men's room. Namely, how fortunate I was to be a regent, what a great honor had been paid me. You know, you even can use honorable before your name when you become a regent. And that now I was a member of just about the most exclusive group, prestige-wise, in the state of California. Really, all I had to do was be a good boy, keep my mouth shut for the first, at least to the end of the governor's term, and learn from my seniors. After all, they've done a magnificent job, and you consider the free speech movement, the filthy speech movement, the fact that the place in a state of extreme emergency, and etc. Support the faculty and administration, protect the university against the great unwashed public. This is the buffer theory, again, of course. And at the end of my term, which is 1984, by the way, perhaps I get an honorary degree, or a building, or a road, or even a sewer system. Imagine that, the sheer impact of having a sewer system named for it. Now, I personally happen to have a different view of the duties of the region. I guess we're trying to bring about a little retrogression in the state of California, as in the case of most states, we hold our position as a public trust. It's clearly stated that it's a public trust for the people of the state of California. In the Constitution, there's no, none of this crap about a bumper and all this business, but it does state that it's our duty and responsibility to promote educational excellence. Now, in the last few months, you've read about the state of California. We've been trying to make a start in that by putting a little steel in the backbone of some of our administrators. And I can assure you that that's a more delicate operation than a heart transplant. Now, I don't intend to talk today, my time is running out, about the various attempts to politicize the student body or politicize the university or to use it as staging grounds for revolution. I think make our universities into Latin American universities. I think we would all agree pretty well on this point. It's deplorable and firm action must be taken against it. I do want to spend just a few moments on a closely related point, which Professor Wiggins referred to earlier. Apparently our governor's been making statements on and again, since it happens to be my favorite point, which he's terribly receptive to. I can assure you no brainwashing was necessary. The problem of faculty imbalance. I personally happen to feel that this is the single most important problem in higher education today. It's not the student activists and revolutionaries, despite the obvious importance of this problem and the enormous publicity, because the hard core, even at Berkeley, the hard core of student activists is still relatively small and could be contained if it wasn't for the active faculty encouragement and organizing activities. Now, as you all know, a favorite proposition in higher education is that it really doesn't make any difference what the political views of social science professors are, as long as they're, quote, competent and objective, close quote. Now, I insist that it does make a great deal of difference. The conservative professors have a habit of seeing greater merits in their fellow conservatives, and vice versa with the liberals. And what has happened in this country since the 1930s is, of course, there's complete imbalance toward the left. I used to say, and I made speeches on this, that in the academic community, the ADA is the middle of the road, but I'm afraid I'm getting a little out of touch, because after what happened to poor old Hubert Humphrey, obviously the ADA is well to the right of center these days, the trouble he had in the academic community. And so, what I'm trying to say is, in my opinion, you only, to promote educational excellence, you really have to have all major points of view represented by people of competence, so that the students can hear all sides of every question and make up their own mind. Because I, for one, have no doubt that, or I should put it in a positive way, I have plenty of faith that our students will make up their mind in a sensible fashion, providing they have a chance to be educated rather than to be indoctrinated. And the old favorite ploy of so many administrators, you know, is to tell you